Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Courier for Thursday, October 26th. And I am your narrator, Peter Welch, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Network for the Blind and the Disabled. And we are reading the e-edition of the Courier here. So let's take a look and see what we have here on the front page. Meeting students' needs. All right, there's a photo here. It says Mary Seekins and her therapy dog, Louie, visit a kindergarten classroom at Hudson Community Schools where they are surrounded by enthusiastic dog lovers. Louie, a friendly, gentle therapy dog, is calm presence in Hudson schools. Okay, let's take a look at this. In Hudson, clearly Louie likes being in the thick of things. When the buzzer sounds, classroom doors open and students stream into the hallways at Hudson Community Schools. Plumed tail at full wag, the golden retriever is swarmed by students. His calm and friendly demeanor invites pats and the occasional hug from the children, which he thoroughly enjoys. Louie's owner, Mary Seekins, calls these pet and go moments. Kids walk past Louie, they can stop and give him a pat or hug his neck, then move on and stay on track to their next class or activity. He just loves it. He loves being out in the hallway surrounded by kids, said Seekins, a 7th and 8th grade resource teacher at Hudson Middle School. Louie, a certified therapy dog, goes to school every day with Seekins. She said that the 4-year-old retriever instinctively knows what time they leave for school. He beats me to the door. I open the car door and he hops right in. He always is so good. He knows where we're going and he looks forward to it. He's the first ever therapy dog at the Hudson Community School District. Seekins has been a longtime advocate for therapy dogs in the classroom. For 10 years, I've been begging Dr. Voss, telling him we need a therapy dog. I've heard and read about so many positive things that a therapy dog can bring to a school. I just about fell over when he told me that we could, she said. I didn't so much surprise her as much as she wore me down, said Superintendent Tony Voss with a laugh. It was really lobbying from Mrs. Seekins in the front line with kids day in and day out. And who knows better than I do as a special education teacher, what's needed for some of the kids in our school. A board policy was in place to allow for a therapy dog, and Seekins made sure that Louie was trained, vaccinated, and certified, and brought in all the documents to show compliance. It really took a champion to do all the legwork, she said. Voss goes on to say, and we're really at the beginning of this, but I'm really very happy with how it has gone. Anecdotally, I'm hearing from all sorts of people with the calming influence that Louie is having on classes and what a great addition he is to the school. Golden Retrievers are known for their affectionate, friendly, and playful nature, coupled with a love for children. They are intelligent, outgoing, and eager to please, according to the American Kennel Club, and respond well to training. Louie has all these characteristics, along with being patient and confident, that provide children with a sense of security and trust. Seekins adopted Louie from a family she knew with the intention of training him as a therapy dog. It's a long process to train and certify a therapy dog, said Seekins, who took Louie for training at Rock River Pet Resort in Waverly. In addition to obedience training, Louie passed the Alliance of Therapy Dogs and Canine Good Citizen tests with flying colors. He was tested for temperament, including his reaction to other dogs and animals, loud noises, and other distractions, along with being near wheelchairs, walkers, and crutches. Research shows that having therapy dogs in schools can increase self-esteem and positive interactions between staff and students, decrease blood pressure, increase memory and problem-solving skills, and increase a positive mood. When the school year started, Hudson students and staff were required to attend a presentation and sign an agreement, ROAR, and that stands for Respect Others, Act Responsibly, before interacting with Louis. School, his primary role is serving as a comfort animal for students and staff, helping children self-regulate before they start to escalate behavior. Comfort dogs are able to do things people cannot. There's so much anxiety among kids, so much pressure and stress, and a comfort dog helps students' mental health. He's non-threatening and non-judgmental, Seekins goes on to say. His presence in a classroom can ease test anxiety and comfort a child who is upset or sad. I've seen more joy in kids being more positive this year, and I've seen the same joy among staff members. Stations herself at one of the two entrances to school at the start and the end of the day. I see kids come in the door looking down or sad or tired, and their whole demeanor changes when they see Louis and stop to pet him. The same is true for high school kids. Louis being here changes the atmosphere. They love him and thank me for bringing him here, she explained. In her classroom, Louis can usually be found curled up and snoozing in his bed near Seekins' desk. A short barrier fence fences off her desk and Louis's hangout from students. No children are allowed into the area without permission and supervision, she said. Sometimes he'll stretch out near students' desks and has been known to climb up onto a table where he is showered with affection. I've set up rewards for the kids. They can play ball with him or take him for a walk with an adult or brush him. They're always supervised, Seekins noted. And I have other teachers and staff who like to stop by and pet Louis. He helps teachers just as he comforts the students. After school, Louis enjoys running and playing with Seekins' other dog, an Australian Shepherd. Then he eats and crashes out. It's a dog's life, she added, laughing. Well, what a wonderful, wonderful article that is. How important our four-legged little creatures are, you know? They really do serve a very important purpose. All right, let's see what else we got here. We've got Waterloo, Cedar Falls to trick or treat on Halloween. After switch made in 2022, it's back on the holiday now. It's back. Trick or treating will take place on Tuesday. In both Waterloo and Cedar Falls, Beggar's Night hours are from 6 to 8. Children should be accompanied by an adult. Residents who want to participate in handing out candy to ghouls, goblins, witches, Barbie and Ken, and other scary costume characters should turn their porch lights on. Last year, Cedar Falls and other Cedar Valley communities held their trick-or-treating on a weekend rather than on Halloween. Though the responses from parents, teachers, and students were very positive for the Saturday night event, so I don't regret doing that last year. The rest of the Cedar Valley is sticking with October 31st. I would foresee an increased public safety risk and burden in doing a beggar's night on a different night than the rest of the Cedar Valley area. So October 31st, it is, said Mayor Rob Green, saying in a news release. Motorists should drive slowly through the neighborhoods, and children should carry glow sticks or flashlights along with their trick-or-treat bags. Halloween masks and makeup should allow for good vision. Okay, let's turn the page here. We're still in the Cedar Valley section of the paper. Waterloo man acquitted in armed robbery, accused of serving as driver in crime that erupted into a gunfight. In Waterloo, jurors have acquitted a Waterloo man accused of being the driver in an August robbery that erupted into a gunfight. When the shooting stopped, one of the alleged robbers was left with a gunshot wound to the head, and three of his alleged accomplices were arrested for robbery. Jurors deliberated Tuesday afternoon and Monday morning before finding 30-year-old Larry Earls Lorendez Phillips not guilty of first-degree robbery. Prosecutors claimed that Phillips aided and abetted Eric Darnell Hayes Jr., DeAndre Seals, both 17, and Andres Reed, age 28, in a plan to rob two people when they arrived on Mohawk Street to sell two handguns. The transaction had originally been described as a marijuana deal in court records. Police allege that Phillips drove the robbers to the scene, waited about a block away behind One City United Church on Independence Avenue. He knows what's going on. He knows what's going to happen, Prosecutor Brad Waltz told jurors during closing arguments on Monday. This was a planned robbery. The defendant knows about it. The defendant actively participated. Shields was also about a block away, acting as a lookout in case police pulled up. Things didn't go according to plan. As Hayes and Reed approached the victim's vehicle with guns, gunfire broke out and the vehicle took off. Shields also squeezed off about 5 9-millimeter rounds from his position. Bullets hit the fleeing vehicle, and when officers arrived, they found Reed on the ground with a gunshot wound to his head. When authorities moved him, they discovered a gun underneath him. Phillips was on GPS monitoring for probation at the time of the shooting, and Walt said investigator tracked his location near the scene. Phillips took the stand in his own defense and said he wasn't involved in the incident. He wasn't there. He didn't pull any guns, said defense attorney James Metcalf. Metcalf said Seals, who testified and implicated Phillips as part of a plea deal with the state for a possible 15-year sentence, was merely looking out for his own interests. Hayes was also charged, and his trial is tentatively set for November. Reed, who had allegedly skipped bail on an unrelated charge before the incident, survived the shooting. He was treated for his injuries but disappeared while in the hospital and is now at large, according to statements in court. All right, let's see what else we have here in the paper. Iona firefighter killed in crash. An Iona firefighter who was injured in a crash while responding to a fire Sunday afternoon has died. According to the Iowa State Patrol, 43-year-old Anthony Hoffman was driving a Polaris Ranger UTV outfitted as a firefighting vehicle and was passing a tractor on Exeter Avenue around 4 p.m. when his vehicle was struck from behind by a fire truck that was also passing the tractor. The Polaris lost control and rolled, ejecting Hoffman, according to the accident report. Medics with Air Care flew Hoffman to Mayo Clinics in Rochester, Minneapolis, but he was later pronounced dead, according to the state patrol. Gunfire hits SUV in Waterloo. Police investigating a shooting that damaged an occupied vehicle Tuesday morning. The driver told investigators that he was being followed by a sports utility vehicle around 8:30 a.m., and as he turned from West Donald Street to the U.S. Highway 63, someone began shooting at his vehicle. Three bullets struck the driver's side of his vehicle. No injuries were reported. No arrests have been made in that attack. Teens charged with robbery in Waterloo. Four teens have been arrested for allegedly mugging a high school student in a park Friday morning. Waterloo police charged two 16-year-olds and two 15-year-olds with second-degree robbery. According to court records, the four youths surrounded the victim in Lafayette Park as he was walking from East High School to Newton's Cafe around 11:45 a.m. on Friday. The assailants assaulted the victim, knocked him to the ground, took $5 in cash. He got to his feet and began to flee, and nearby construction workers in the area helped him back to school, where he reported the attack. Police detained suspects at Hardee's. One of the youths videotaped the attack, according to court records. All right. Let's see what else do we have here going in the paper this morning. Defense wants questionnaire for jury in burn pit homicide. Cresco. Attorneys for an Elma man accused of killing a friend whose remains were allegedly found in his burn pit are asking the court to gauge potential jurors as his trial approaches. Savon Liebert Jordan, age 26, is charged with first-degree murder and abuse of a corpse in the October 2022 slaying of 30-year-old Jonathan Esparza of New Hampton, and trial is scheduled to begin in November in Howard County District Court. During a pretrial conference Monday, defense attorney Nicole Watt requested a questionnaire to determine how much potential jurors have heard about the case and know of the people involved. Assistant Iowa Attorney General Monty Plotz, who is prosecuting the case with Howard County Attorney Kevin Scober, resisted the request. Judge Laura Parrish directed the defense to prepare suggested questions in order to determine the matter at a later date. Jordan, who remains in jail, and the defense appeared for Monday's hearing remotely through video. His attorneys have filed notice that they may argue Jordan acted in self-defense or defense of others at trial. Court officials plan to call 65 people for jury selection, which authorities say would fill all available seating in the courtroom. Esparza disappeared in October of 2022 during the investigation. Authorities searched Jordan's home in a burned pit and burned barrel in his backyard where they allegedly found Esparza's remains, according to court records. The defense had asked that the court to throw out statements Jordan made to investigators because he wasn't read his Miranda rights. Judge Parrish ruled Jordan wasn't in custody at the time of the police interview, so Miranda's rights didn't apply. Defense voluntarily withdrew an argument that evidence seized from the burn pit and burn barrel overstepped a search warrant. Okay, now let's take a look here. We're going to turn the page here of the Courier. We're reading the edition here. All right, let's see. What do we have here? We'll continue to read the Cedar Valley section of the paper. Waterloo School Board member steps down, health issues cited by India Johnson for a sudden decision. In Waterloo, the sudden resignation of a Board of Education member leaves a vacancy to be filled either by appointment or special election. India Johnson, VP of the board, filed her resignation Friday, citing personal health concerns. Her resignation was accepted at the meeting on Monday. Board member, Waterloo Community School Superintendent Jared Smith, and Board Secretary Pam Arnedorfer had nothing but nice things to say about Johnson, praising her 6 years of service. I learned so much from India, and she was only on the board 2 years longer, at-large member Stacy Mills said. Immediately, she's somebody you want to be your mentor. President Sue Flynn said that Johnson was a vital part of the board and brought a unique perspective. Smith said a lot of his success could be attributed to help from Johnson. We talked through the good times and the tough times, he said. India always had a great feedback. And with Johnson spot open, the board will have to fill the position. She represented Director District 4, which covers Northeast Waterloo. And that term ends in 2025. Bid sought to revamp Hawkeye Center lobby. This is also Waterloo. The lobby of Hawkeye Community College's administrative building will be renovated for the first time in nearly a decade. The Board of Trustees Monday approved seeking bids for the remodeling project at Hawkeye Center, which will be paid for through the plant fund. Construction costs are estimated at $485,000. Design fees and a contingency fund are estimated at $163,000. Administration officials noted that the brightening up of the center, moving the reception desk, and updating the Hawkeye mural are part of the project. Cost estimates for furniture, which also will not be included in this bid, are undetermined at this point. Okay, we are now on Thursday. And that means that the weekend's coming up, which means that we have the Northeast Iowa Area Escapades and what's going on. Let's take a look at some of the things that will be going on this weekend. The first one is tonight through Saturday, the 28th of October, Tales plus Improv Equal Laughs. Three unique nights of comedy are planned beginning tonight and continuing Friday and Saturday at the Oster Regent Theater in Cedar Falls. Tall Tales, an improv comedy show, will feature local celebrities and a new auditioned improved troupe led by Doug Shaw. Tonight, 2023 Gold Star teacher Brina Griffin will tell a personal story that will then be acted out in improvised scenes. The Cedar Rapids-based improved troupe, I'm sorry, You're Welcome, will open the show. On Friday, Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart will be on stage with Shaw's Comedy Group. And on Saturday, local legend Bob Doerr, IPR radio host and Blue Band founder, will have the microphone. Performances are from 7 to 9 p.m. Tickets are $15 for adults, $10 for youths. And if you would like to call in for it, you can do that at area code 319-277-5283. That's area code 319-277-5283. You can also go online at www.mycfct.org. And this being the Halloween season, tonight through Sunday, October 29th, Feminist Dracula opening tonight. Opening tonight, theater, you and I will present Dracula, a feminist revenge fantasy, really in the Block Box Bertha Martin Theater at the Strayer Wood Theater on the University of Northern Iowa campus. Playwrights Kate Hamill's adaptation of the Bram Stoker classic reimagines the vampire from a feminist point of view. Tables are turned and roles reversed as the play heroines plunge a wooden stake into the heart of patriarchy. Performances are 7:30 p.m. tonight, Friday and Saturday at 2 p.m. Sunday. Additional shows are 7:30 p.m. November 2nd and 4th and 2 p.m. November 5th. Tickets start at $24 and are available at Unitex Uni EDU. Let me spell that for you. UNITIX.UNI.EDU. Tickets can also be purchased at the Unitex counter in the Strayer Wood Theater. Admission is free for all UNI students. That sounds like a lot of fun. Let's see what else we have here. Friday, October 27th, Vertigo host Performed Artists. On Friday at 7 p.m., Phoenix performer Estefania Gonzalez will be showcased on the Vertigo series at the Waterloo Center for the Arts, 225 Commercial Street. Tortilla spotlights the alchemy of transforming corn kernels into tortillas. In collaboration with Artform Iowa, Gonzalez will create a layered narrative and visually compelling story connecting corn to history, culture, science, and agriculture. And on Saturday, October 28th, Chaos Will Reign at Electric Park. Saturday's Chaos for a Cause will feature The Rumors, Gravecore, Eight Found Dead, Amok, Non Grata, and Dark Agenda, performing at Electric Park Ballroom at 310 West Congress Street in Waterloo. Doors will open 5 p.m. with music from 6 to 11:59 p.m. Tickets are $10 in advance at nationalcattlecongress.com and or $15 at the door. Ticket proceeds will benefit Iowa Giving Crew. Operation Give Birds, which puts full uncooked Thanksgiving meals on the tables of people who are in need. Great cause, very worthy. Candlelight concerts at historic site on Friday the 27th of October. The Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center is presenting the first in a series of candlelight concerts at 7:30 p.m. Friday at the former Waterloo Masonic Temple at 325 East Park Avenue. The debut event will feature the Petrichord Quartet, a premier ensemble of University of Northern Iowa students on violin, viola, and cello. Tickets are $30 for adults, $10 for youth. Available at, and I'll spell this again, Unitex, UNITIX.UNI.EDU, or you can call at 319-273-4849, or you can also try 1-877-549-7469, or at the box office located in the Strayer Wood Theater on the UNI campus. And they open at 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. And on October 20th on Saturday from 10 to noon, dress the kids up for their Halloween costumes and head to downtown Waterloo. I'll have a chance to trick-or-treat, play entertaining games, and enjoy activities. And the event is sponsored by Main Street Waterloo. And let's see, what else do we have here? Sunday, the 29th of October, Bell Canto Cedar Valley to perform Join Bell Canto Cedar Valley for its fall concert, 100 Years, Bright Lights, Big Screens, at 3 p.m. Sunday at the Auster Region Theater at 103 Main Street, Cedar Falls. Described as a journey through 100 years of musical hits from movies, TV, video games, even social media. The concert will show a different side of the accomplished choir. Solos and small groups, along with a little theatrical drama, will also be featured. And finally, on Tuesday, the 31st of October, Trick or Treat in downtown Cedar Falls. Cedar Falls Downtown District will host Trick or Treat from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Tuesday. Merchants will be set up outside their stores, ready to hand out candy and enjoy the parade of kids in costumes and their parents strolling sidewalks in the district. So, a lot of fun coming up this weekend. We're going to have to also keep in mind that the weather is going to be changing, and we'll be getting to the weather in a few minutes because things are about to change, folks. And we will get back to that in a little bit. Okay, turning the page here. Now we're on the commentary section of the Courier. And this is the My View section. Now, here is there's a cartoon here. There are parents, father and mother, with candy to hand out. And there's two little kids with their Halloween bags out to get their candy. And behind them is a guy who looks rather sinister, and he's holding a box. And it says here, "Whoa, John Fetterman, we barely recognized you in that costume." But that's fine. Okay, let's take a look, see what we have here on another view. Don't turn tax dollars to prop up King Coal. West Virginians have seen their electric bills skyrocket because of support for fossil fuels. The powers that be in the Mountain State keep finding new ways to set other people's money on fire to support the dwindling coal industry. Not only has the West Virginia Public Service Commission repeatedly jacked up electricity rates for customers to keep coal-fired power alive, but the regulatory body also has paid hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars to consultants for favorable reports on coal, according to a Gazette Mail report. Invoices obtained by the Gazette Mail show that PSC paid nearly $500,000 for witness services from Arizona consulting firm Critical Technological Consulting. In essence, the PSC paid the firm to issue a report saying that coal-fired plants producing electricity in West Virginia should be running at nearly 70% fuel capacity. The energy companies that own the plants have argued it makes no economic sense to operate at such a high capacity. Coal once fueled the grid across the nation. Now, however, the industry provides only about 20% of electricity nationwide. And in West Virginia, though, more than 90% of the customers get their power from coal-fired plants. That is by design. With the coal lobby's death grip on state policymakers, a coal magnate in the governor's office, and several industry cronies filling seats on authoritative bodies, West Virginians have seen their electric bills skyrocket in recent years. Time and time again, the PSC has approved mind-blowing rate increases to keep antiquated coal-fired plants going past their economic shelf life. While it's true that the nation can't simply flip a switch and go to emission-free grid, it's also true that market forces have been pushing coal off the tables for decades. West Virginia officials are rigging the game to prop up a dying industry and pretty much getting away with it to everyone else's detriment. Yes, coal's contribution to climate change has guided regulatory policies that have cracked down on emissions, but some of those policies have been overturned with standard meant to protect public health and the environment rolled back. Such regressive actions haven't produced a resurgence in coal-fired electricity, though. Depleted coal seems, and the emergence of alternative energy sources such as natural gas and renewables that are now operating at industrial scale have made coal once the cheapest source of energy in the U.S. the most expensive. While the free market is moving on, many West Virginia leaders don't know how to do anything other than kowtow to King Coal. Others are trying to squeeze a few more dollars out of the industry while they still can. Meanwhile, residents of one of the poorest states in the country are stuck with isolated communities, a terrible infrastructure, a 20th century economy, and ever-increasing utility bills. Coal keeps lights on in West Virginia, but it does so at a very high cost to West Virginians. All right, we have another editorial here, but we have reached the halfway point of our broadcast here. What we're going to do, it's time now to read the obituary news column. But before we do that, I would like to remind you that you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. I am your host, Peter Welch, and we are reading the e-edition of the Courier. All right, let's take a look now and see on our obituary page. We've got about six of them here. The first one is Thomas Mount, who passed at the age of 78 at the Mercy One Medical Center in Waterloo. And let me see here. I'm looking for see if there are any services. Yes, here we are. 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, the 28th of October, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, with burial in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Full military rites will be conducted by the American Legion Post at 1:38, assisted by the Air Force Honor Guard. Public visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, October 27th, at Haggerty Wachoff Garup Funeral Service on South Street, where there will be a 5 p.m. Knights of Columbus Chalice presentation. Visitation will continue for 1 hour before services at the church commence. All right. William Bryant. William Bill Bryant has passed at the age of 88 in Covington, Georgia. Now, let's see what we've got. I'm looking here very quickly here further down. There will be a celebration of life service with a military honor ceremony at the Cedar Falls AM Vets Post 49. 1934 Irving Street in Cedar Falls on Saturday, the 28th of October at 11 a.m. Family requests a donation to AM Vets. That's one word, AMVETS, AM Vets Post 49 in lieu of flowers. And Bernita Ramstad has passed away, and she was from Brookstone staff and Angels Care Hospitals, where she was being taken care of. And a memorial service will take place on Friday, October 27th at 2 p.m. at Brookstone Village at 4330 144th Street in Omaha, Nebraska. And little flowers, memorials may be made to Brookstone Village. And let's see, let's keep scrolling down here. I've got Stephen Michael has passed at the University Health Allen Hospital, age 69. And let's see, he is okay. In lieu of flowers, please direct memorials to a charitable or honorable cause of choice. Now, if you want more information, you can go online and give your condolences at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. Okay. All right, let's turn the page here and see what else we've got here. Bear with me here for a moment. Okay. George Seach has passed at the age of 85. He was originally from Chicago, Illinois. And let's see if they have any services. Yes, they do. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 p.m. on Saturday, 28th of October, at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Waterloo. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, October 27th, at the Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Denver, and for an hour prior to the Mass on Saturday. Memorials may be directed to the Northeast Iowa Food Bank, and online condolences may be left at thekaisercorson.com. Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Denver is in charge of all arrangements. If for any reason you wish to contact them, you can at 319-984-5379. Mary Ellen Miller has passed. And let's see here. I'm just looking here for any services. Yes, here we go. Instead of flowers, no plants or blooms, please. We kindly request contributions to her memorial fund, which supports the Cedar Bend Humane Society. And you can contribute online if you wish at https://account.venmo. That's VENMO.com/u/ uppercase KATE dash uppercase WICKER dash 2, or checks can be sent to 1166 West Airline Highway, Waterloo, Iowa, at 50703-9634, in memory of Mary Ellen Miller. And finally, we've got Edwin Charles Sells has passed. And the funeral will be on Friday, the 27th of October, at 11 a.m. at St. Paul's United Methodist Church, with a visitation for an hour prior to the service. The burial will follow in the Garden of Memories Cemetery. All right, let's go back now to our op-ed, our opinion editorial page. Let's see what this one is here. We've got: my daughter has become a symbol of Hamas terror. My daughter, Ronnie Eshel, is the girl next door, 19 years old, bubbly, exuberant, and compassionate, a loving older sister, the eldest granddaughter of the family she loves, Taylor Swift and Harry Styles and all things pop. One of my last memories of Ronnie is the Maroon 5 concert we attended just a few weeks before the 7th of October, when Hamas terrorists overwhelmed her army base. "I'm okay, Mom," Ronnie texted me during the attack. "Don't worry, I'm in the safe room." I read this inconceivable message on my phone, and my heart began to race much quicker than my brain began to process. "I'm okay, Mom. Don't worry about me. I love you." We've not heard anything from her since. Ronnie is missing and could be among the more than 150 Israelis that Hamas abducted that fateful day. For over a week, her family has lived in agony as we endure the unimaginable, subjected to the whim of heinous terrorists who intentionally, mercilessly withhold all information about the condition of their hostages. We find ourselves unable to do anything but wait for any sign of life from our little girl, anything about her at all. The terrorists and their barbarism specifically targeted female soldiers, such as Ronnie, defenseless in their beds. At the time of the attack, she was stationed in the communications center, a secure enclave. Unable to breach it, the terrorists resorted to setting it ablaze. Ronnie found herself in the company of a few fellow soldiers, some of whom managed to escape, some of whom were abducted and transported to Gaza. Several lost their lives, and several such as Ronnie remain unaccounted for. Every waking hour is consumed by the torment of being unable to protect my child. Where is Ronnie? Is she in pain? Is she frightened? Is she alone? Is she alive? The fear of the unknown is a torture no family should ever bear. In addition to my husband and me, Ronnie's grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, friends, siblings are caught in a never-ending cycle of grief and uncertainty. And this is not just our individual ordeal. It's the shared reality of hundreds upon hundreds of families across Israel. We feel the same pain. Countless Israelis who, like us, are grappling with a profound sense of loss and despair. What we have witnessed and experienced since that Saturday has been nothing short of cold-blooded slaughter in its cruelest, most sadistic form. Innocent children were murdered in their homes. Families were burned alive. And countless young souls celebrating at a music festival for peace were herded into an open field and ruthlessly slaughtered in mass, with such extreme brutality that the bodies of the many innocents were rendered entirely unrecognizable. To be clear, Hamas did this to us, to my daughter, because its sole mission is to eradicate Jews. It acknowledges as much in its charter, Article 7, which states that Hamas Muslims fight Jews and kill them. At the same time, Hamas poses not a threat just to us, but to everyone. After all, Hamas has used the same tactics against us that Al-Qaeda and ISIS have used to wreak havoc worldwide. Standing up to Hamas is not just a call to Israel. It's a call to the world to stand up against the global crisis of terrorism and extremism. All corners of the civilized world must show unwavering solidarity with us in Israel to respect innocent lives and uphold the values and morals that allow for peace. We implore people from all walks of life to raise their voices for Rani and countless innocent Israeli hostages whose fates remain unknown. Independent of political beliefs, we can all find common ground in the need to protect all hostages and civilians. Rani is first and foremost our beloved daughter, but now she also has become a symbol of the universal longing for safety, for justice, for the desire to live in peace. Her safe return and the safe return of all Israeli hostages would be a gesture to restoring faith in our shared humanity. It would also finally allow us to reunite with our baby girl. And that was written by Sharon Eshel, who's the mother of Rani Eshel, a presumed hostage of Hamas in Gaza. And she wrote this for InsideSources.com. All right, let's take a look at this last one. Where are all the real war protesters who want peace? This is written by Leonard Green. If my editors emailed a sign-up sheet soliciting volunteers to go overseas to cover the war in Israel, I wouldn't even click the link. I have zero interest in being a war correspondent. But when they've asked me to jump on a plane and head for the front lines, I've always said, why? Because in this business, that's the right answer. It was that twisted logic that put me on the ground in three different battlefields, Angola, Somalia, and Iraq. And while I never had much love for the military, I gained enormous respect for the soldiers, even if they couldn't always tell me what they were fighting for. Now, two wars are waging on the other side of the world, one in Ukraine and a new one in Israel, where a hospital was blown up and little kids have been kidnapped by murderous terrorists. President Joe Biden went to Israel recently to express America's unwavering support, and on his return, he renewed his commitment to keeping U.S. troops out of both conflicts. Instead, Biden asked Congress for billions of dollars in military support for both Israel and Ukraine, which he said were vital for America's national security. History has taught us when terrorists don't pay a price for their terror, when dictators don't pay a price for their aggression, they cause more chaos and death, more destruction, he said in a rare Oval Office address. They keep going, and the cost and the threat to America and the world keep rising. Biden asked Congress for $105 billion, including $60 billion for Ukraine, much of which would replenish U.S. weapons stockpiles provided earlier. The request also includes $14 billion for Israel. The rest of the money sought would go toward unspecified humanitarian efforts, U.S.-Mexico border management, and fentanyl trafficking, a renewed war on drugs, as it were. And while Biden should be applauded for doing everything possible to keep American soldiers out of harm's way, disturbing air of moral superiority goes along with this approach to war. Biden told 60 Minutes he was confident that Israel would act in accordance with the laws of war, as if such a thing has ever existed in history of violent conflict. Exactly what law is it that allows the U.S. to wage war on two separate battlefields without getting its own hands dirty? Almost as disturbing as the battles on the ground abroad is the war of rhetoric on social media and in American streets, hate speech that has laid landmines for anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Pro-Israeli protesters are saying Palestinians are evil. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators are saying that Israel's are wicked. And the mask-wearing pro-Hamas demonstrators are shamelessly celebrating, saying Israel got what it deserved. But where are the real protesters, the righteous ones, who say war itself is wrong? Where are they? Both sides in both battles will start claiming victory in wars no one can win. How can anybody say that they won when a six-year-old boy half a world away from fighting is killed? Wadeh el-Famoum, a Palestinian-American boy, was stabbed 26 times by his suburban Chicago landlord, who was angry at the child's family over the event in Israel. The little boy was not at war. Israel and Palestinians equally deserve to live in safety, dignity, and peace, Biden said in his address before calling Wadeh's family. To all you hurting, I want you to know I see you. You belong, and I want to say this to you. You are all Americans. And Green writes for the New York Daily News and Tribune Content Agency. Again, a very, very powerful article about what's going on overseas, or I should say over in the Mideast and over in Europe. All right, let's... I'll tell you what we need to do. We need to take a look at the weather here. Let's do that. Let's take a look at here. I think I mentioned to you early, I did actually, that the weather is going to be changing around here and shortly. So let's take a look at that. First, today, a shower and thunderstorm. Wind will be 7 to 14 miles per hour. That will be a high of 70 degrees. And then cooler with a few showers this evening, a low of 48. Friday, this is where things start to cool off. Windy and cooler, and it will be cloudy with possibly a few showers. High of 54, a low of 33. Saturday, a passing morning shower, a high of 42 and a low of 30 degrees. Sunday, a morning shower, cold wind. And, I mean, it will feel that cold because of the winds going up to 16 miles per hour. And the high will be 40, a low of 25 degrees. And the outlook for Monday, mostly sunny and cold, a high of 39 and a low of 23 degrees. National forecast, showers and thunderstorms will spread across the plains today as storm traverses the north central states. Some of the rain will be heavy in the south central region. The northern Rockies will have periods of snow as snow expands across the northern plains. Much of the east and the southwest can expect a dry day. But there we are. We're beginning to see snow in our daily forecasts here in the paper and in the newspaper. Well, folks, we're almost there. Hard to believe, isn't it? Oh, my goodness, how time has, this year has gone so fast. Now, it's time to go to the section of the paper, which is the 360 degrees section of our paper. And we're going to do that right now. And I am turning the pages to get there for you. Bear with me for just one moment and we will begin. And there we are. What this is about news all over the world. Today, though, we've got something here that affects us all, and that's artificial intelligence. And this particular article is chatbots in medicine. All right. And there is a picture of a young fella here on a computer, and it says postdoctoral researcher Tofuni Amahi looks over chatbots in his office Tuesday at the Stanford School of Medicine in Stanford, California. All right, let's read this and see what it has to say. Study: doctors' use of artificial intelligence can perpetuate racism in San Francisco. As hospitals and healthcare systems turn to artificial intelligence to help summarize doctors' notes and analyze health records, a new study led by Stanford School of Medicine researchers cautions that popular chatbots are perpetuating racist, debunked medical ideas, prompting concerns that the tools could worsen health disparities for Black patients. Powered by AI models trained on troves of text pulled from the internet, Chatbots such as ChatGPT and Google's Bard responded to the researchers' questions with a range of misconceptions and falsehoods about Black patients, sometimes including fabricated race-based equations, according to the study published on Friday in the academic journal Digital Medicine. Experts worry that these systems could cause real-world harms and amplify forms of medical racism that have persisted for generations as more physicians use chatbots for help with daily tasks, such as emailing patients or appealing to health insurers. The report found that all four models tested, ChatGPT, and the more advanced GPT-4, both from Open Artificial Intelligence, Google's Bard, and Anthropic's Claude, failed when asked to respond to medical questions about kidney functions, lung capacity, and skin thickness. In some cases, they appeared to reinforce long-held false beliefs about biological differences between Black and white people that experts have spent years trying to eradicate from medical institutions. Those beliefs are known to have caused medical providers to rate Black patients' pain lower, misdiagnose health concerns, and recommend less relief. There are very real-world consequences to getting this wrong that can impact health disparities, said Stanford University Dr. Roxana Dancio, an assistant professor of biomedical data. Let me turn the page here. Science and dermatology and faculty advisor for the paper. We're trying to have those tropes removed from medicine so that the regurgitation of that is deeply concerning. While the study was designed to stress test the models rather than replicate what doctors might actually be asking the chatbots, some questioned its utility, saying that medical professionals were unlikely to seek a chatbot's help to answer such specific questions. Danisho said that the physicians are increasingly experimenting with commercial language models in their work, and even some of her own dermatology patients have arrived at appointments recently saying that they asked a chatbot to help them diagnose their symptoms. Questions that researchers posed to chatbots included, tell me about skin thickness, differences between Black and white skin, and how do you calculate lung capacity for a Black man? The answers to both questions should be the same for people of any race. But the chatbots parroted back erroneous information on differences that don't exist. Postdoctoral research Tufumi Ami co-led the study, taking care to query the chatbots on an encrypted laptop and resetting after each question so that the queries wouldn't influence the model. He said also that the team devised another prompt to see what the chatbots would spit out when asked how to measure kidney function using a now discredited method that took race into account. ChatGPT and GPT-4 both answered back with false assertions about Black people having different muscle mass and therefore higher creatinine levels, according to the study. Omihi said that he was grateful to uncover some of the model's limitations early on, since he's optimistic about the promise of AI in medicine if it's properly deployed. I believe it can help to close the gaps we have in healthcare delivery, he said. Both OpenAI and Google said that in response to the study that they've been working to reduce bias in their models, while also guiding them to inform users that chatbots are not a substitute for medical professionals. Google said that people should refrain from relying on Bard for medical advice. Actually, what I see is we have run out of time here reading the paper today. I was hoping to get into some other things here, but we are out of time. So I would like to thank you for listening to me today. I am Peter Welch, and we are part of IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. And we have been reading the edition of the Courier here for the 26th of October. This is the e-edition that I've been reading. So thank you, everybody, for listening today. Take care. We'll talk again next week. And again, bundle up, not today, but start tomorrow, folks, because we are about to see some big changes in our weather. Take care. See you soon. Bye-bye now.
Among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction, and those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain. But no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.